Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Captain Shen. Going green starts with, well, where we live. So all week, we'll be talking about climate in honor of Earth Day. As a part of our Earth Week celebrations, today we hear from two reporters from the New England News Collaborative reporting on the intersection of climate change and housing. The New England News Collaborative is a 9-station consortium of public media newsrooms. The use and construction of buildings accounts for at least 37% of energy-related carbon dioxide emissions. That's according to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, also known as IPCC. But before we get to green housing, we're going to focus on green spaces. And joining us now is someone working to bring more green spaces to New Haven. We have Jonathan Savage, who is the executive director of Gather New Haven. Thank you so much, Jonathan, for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And for our listeners, let us know if you have any questions. Give us a call, 888-720-9677, or leave us a comment on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. So, Jonathan, I want to learn more about Gather New Haven in a quick second, but want to ask you first, you know, what is your connection to land and how did you get interested in cultivation of land in the first place?
My interest in cultivation of land and kind of being outside started when I was really young. Both my grandparents on both sides, or both sets of grandparents on both sides of my family, were migrants from the South and brought up from the South a love for growing their own food. Mm. So by age 3, 4, I was like hands in the dirt. Pretty much all the kids were my cousins, learning how to grow and kind of helping out my grandmothers. But by age 5, I had my own garden. My parents like lovingly dug up the front yard of our home, and I've been growing food in New Haven for the last 35 years.
And it seems like this is a trend sort of passing. I mean, this is kind of beyond gardening, but something that's cultivated generation to generation. How do you think that experience has informed you? Because, I mean, just from your very brief description, it sounds like a very positive experience.
Yeah, it shaped my outlook on where food come from, what healthy and kind of fresh food looks like. I always kind of tell the story. I can remember the time when we went to the store. I might have been 7, 8 years old, and I realized that certain vegetables, specifically collard greens, came from the grocery store, right? And people actually went and bought that specific item as opposed to just going to the store for meats and some other things. So,
I love that because my parents, my mom especially, used to get fresh groceries. I lived in Taiwan for a couple of years, and then we will always have the open air markets with fresh produce. Mm-hmm. I actually didn't know certain vegetables could come in cans. Like, that was a mind-blowing thing for me. It was just not a thing.
Yep.
And so I definitely have an appreciation for seeing your produce coming out from the earth. And how were you able to sort of to connect your experience growing up, you know, as a young person, mm-hmm. having that experience into your adulthood?
As a young person, it really became one of the things that defined me for the people who knew me. I was always known as having a few green thumbs. And once I got to high school, I kind of saw people kind of finding ways to create income and going for jobs. And my thing was utilizing the skill that I had been working on for the beginning of my life. So I would sell collard greens out my trunk, and I learned how to can. So I was making like fermented hot sauces and making jams, and that kind of became my like source of income at that young age, right before you can really go get a job. But it also kind of gave me a sense of the capability for like turning a skill that you have into an entrepreneurial venture.
And did that also lead you to, because I think before you went to Gather New Haven, you were working in youth services, and it sounds like you also integrated gardening into that. Can you talk about that experience?
Yep. So I spent 17 years working in youth services, social work area at the beginning of my work career. And from preschool all the way through working in alternative ed, wherever I was, I brought growing into the space. So at a program that had a yard or a field, I would try to introduce, like, let's grow some vegetables in the back. All the way to when I was teaching mathematics at a private alternative school called Passages, I would do organic versus hydroponic experiments with strawberries in the window with the kids, and just really trying to pass on that introduction and experience to growing. At that point, they were in high school, but as young as I could reach people, because I always was aware that even if it didn't become like, I'm going to do this all the time, and like, this is my favorite hobby, it is something that once you know it, it doesn't go away. And you find that eventually these kind of lifelong skills come back to you as you get older and kind of chill out a little bit.
Well, and with that range too, from preschool to high school, do the kids or have the kids like reacted differently? Were they excited, or you know, what did you witness with that?
So the younger the kids are, the happier they are to kind of be hands in the dirt, and it starts, the excitement starts from that side. And then kind of their patience is a little bit more. So you tailor it, you grow really faster things, and, you know, so they can really kind of get that experience really quickly. As the kids got older, you kind of started seeing, especially the ones who hadn't been introduced to growing at all, the skepticism, right? This little bare root strawberry plant that doesn't even look alive. Will it even turn into a plant, A? And then how does a strawberry come from this, right? And you see the progression of, like, the thought in their mind where I can see this becoming a strawberry as the first flowers come out. And then as you're like, hey, look at that flower. Don't the petals look like the top of a strawberry? And they're like, wait, it does, you know? And that excitement comes. And then all of a sudden, these kids who were like, I don't care about growing, they see the first strawberry on their plant. And then now they have, like, arms around their pots, like, protecting it from the other kids, because like they can see like what they've achieved.
That actually will make me not want to eat it because it took so long. And I love the excitement, because this is exciting, and it is fun to get your hands dirty and really sort of start that cultivation. So can you tell me about, you know, that you did that for 17 years and your trajectory going into Gather New Haven, and what did it look like for you to cultivate green spaces for the community in that capacity?
It was an exciting change. Not that I didn't love the where my career was going. You're always blessed if you can find a career or a job where you can take a lifelong personal passion, something you would do regardless, and then add it to kind of the work and experiences that you've had over your career. So Gather New Haven gave me that happy medium for learning how to grow, or getting a space to grow at scale, right? And really start providing and food to the community. And really for myself, it was a journey of growth in my growing, right? Going from a gardener and a true grower of really everything from citrus plants to vegetables to fruits, into really growing at, you know, on 2-3 acres of farmland, and lucky enough to do it within New Haven, right? And then the vegetables I'm growing are given out through donation or free CSAs, and very cost equitable farm stands. So really giving access to these fresh vegetables that I know a lot of people in my community just don't have access to.
Well, I want to talk about the equity a little bit too, because so it sounds like you're doing a lot of different kind of growing. You're growing literal vegetables and fruits, but you're also growing your career where you can sort of include that growth and encourage that growth in the communities as well. So can you talk about some of the programs that you're working with, especially community gardens? I know that plays a really big part of what you do, right?
Yes, our community garden network consists of 44 community gardens, all within the city limits of New Haven, serving over 500 families, I believe, at this point.
Wow.
And, you know, individuals, the numbers are really great. But it really gives access to spaces for people to grow not only their food, but also a sense of community, right? Because these green spaces are hubs within the city, right? And the more active they are, the more connected the community members are together, the more events you start seeing happening. And all of a sudden there's a book club at a community garden, or there, you know, and they really kind of become self-sufficient. Gather just becomes a intermediary who kind of makes sure the space is there, make sure it's upkept for the most part, providing seedlings and providing raised beds when they need to be built and built in soil, but really allowing them to be autonomous, right, and grow how they want to grow, whether it be individual garden plots or growing as a communal kind of farm type site at the community garden. Giving them the space to kind of shape how they're going to create that community and how they're going to interact within that community around the community gardens.
And can you talk about, you know, how do you start a community garden? What's the process when you're looking into creating either a community garden or a green space?
Okay. So the model around kind of Gather New Haven is generally people will come to us. There will be an empty lot that nothing's been done with for a while. Honestly, there are a lot of those lots actually start off as guerrilla gardens, right? There's an empty lot, nothing's going on. Somebody decides to plant something. Eventually, the ask comes to us. We will go to the city, and if it's a city-owned piece of land, and look to get a lease. Once that happens, we start with the soil tests and kind of whatever work we need to do to make sure that they're growing in healthy soil. A lot of times, due to the fact that pretty much all major cities are, their soils are laden with lead, just as a consequence of all the paints that we used over the years. So especially old cities like New Haven.
Sure.
So generally we don't grow in the native soil. Either we pull the soil out and replace it. And that's usually on the farms, but on the community gardens, we generally build up. So we build raised beds,
right.
We put down fabric and cloth to separate from the native soil and then fill in with good compost. And then kind of it builds around what the community members want at that point, right? Do they want long beds so they can share, individual beds so they can have their own space, both of which are important, right? Some people need that community to grow together.
Right.
And some people actually have no personal space because they're renting or whatever other reason, their backyard is not a good place to grow. So it gives them a space to kind of have some ownership, right? And that's something that's lost a lot on the needs of the people within urban spaces, right? That having a bit of ownership when you seem to be renting and kind of leasing everything in your life gives you a sense of stability.
Well, I love that connection because I want to also talk about environmental justice. You know, you mentioning ownership and to have that stability, because that's not something that we all have, right? And so according to the Connecticut Data Collaborative, based on their data, in the towns with greater than 35% of their population of people of color, their median green space percentage was 55.5% in comparison to the state median of 70.38%. So that's quite a gap there. So can you talk about the role, you know, what role does creating these green spaces and community gardens play in terms of promoting environmental justice?
It lets people see what they're missing, I think, sometimes, especially with our larger spaces. Having preserves that are around the city and accessible to the city members, where you can get into the forest or you can get into a wetland. I know for me personally, getting outside has always been like a respite from the stresses of life, the stresses of the day. I love to fish, right, and interact with nature, and keeping these spaces around gives that a little bit of that equity back, right? You don't have to be in a suburban environment or a rural environment to have access to the forest, right? We should always be able to go sun forest bathe if we want, or go take a walk under a wooded canopy, right? And really just be able to reflect with ourselves. And the green spaces, the smaller community garden green spaces, and also the farms where we try to hold workshops and do community events around those spaces as well, just give people a chance to get outside, right? And that's good for your mental health. That's good for your physical health. So the positives definitely are abundant when you start talking about giving access to green spaces within the city.
Right. And then with your talk about access and also that abundance, you know, once these spaces are created, and I pass by quite a few coming to work and they always make me kind of joyful. And I'm looking forward to them being a little bit green again, just because in the winter it's very stark. But, you know, once these spaces are created, you know, how are you able to preserve them and make sure that they do remain in these communities?
So we're very lucky to have city officials. The city of New Haven is really great. They are very supportive of the work that we're trying to do in keeping these green spaces, as community gardens. So generally, we don't have the issues that some cities have where their green spaces and community gardens that are on these leases are being pulled back, right, for development, and which is very important. You know, cost-effective housing is very important in the city, but at the same time, if you create too much housing but don't have spaces of respite, like I said, and spaces for these people to go outside or be able to grow their own food, right, they're losing something at the same time that they almost feel like they're gaining something. But definitely lucky that the city of New Haven has been a really great partner in allowing us to work to keep these spaces green and keep them open to the public.
Well, we've been talking about sort of the physical space and the mental health aspect of this. So I want to also talk about physical health, because a big part of what you do at Gather New Haven is the farm-based wellness program. And so this is a program that's designed for individuals who are diagnosed with diet-related conditions such as diabetes. So can you talk about the connection between gardening and cultivating the land and wellness and how that's all related to each other?
So, as you said, farm-based wellness is our mostly geared towards diabetes prevention. It is a diabetes prevention curriculum, but really works with anyone with any physical ailment that can be tied to their health. And most ailments, if your gut health is doing a little bit better based on the things that you're putting in your system, it's very helpful for whatever kind of whatever disease you have. So. Farm-based wellness, they get out on the farm, they get to actually get physical activity as a group out on the farm, but they also get free CSA shares. So for my first 3 years at Gather, I was the farm manager, so part of my job and a big part of the vegetables that came out of the farm was being given free to the people within the program, right? So not only do we promote eating healthy and living a healthier lifestyle based on your diet, we also say and recognize that if people could eat better, generally they would, right? If everyone could afford Whole Foods, most people would shop at Whole Foods. Mm-hmm. The problem is a lack of access or capability to be able to shop at some of these places and acquire some of these high nutrient dense foods. So really providing those and giving the training for how people can provide those to themselves is very key, right, to changing people's lives in a very concrete way. And then once people graduate from the program, it's a 16-week curriculum that after the curriculum ends, they still get farm shares and they kind of go through monthly meetings afterwards. They are all promoted to get into our community gardens. So now you've come in, you've learned how to change your life around your food, your diet, and then we also try to bring you into one of these community spaces, right? So it keeps you around people who are of the same mindset, thinking about what I'm eating and the effects on my health, the effects on my mental health, physical health, and in terms of people who are really are pre-diabetic, it's very big in changing their lives.
Well, and it sounds like here too, you are also breaking cycles. So in an adult, they learn about their needs later on, but able to sort of change your habits, right? Mm-hmm. We also started the conversation earlier today about working with young people. So we know that a lot of these diet-related illnesses often exist in families. So can you talk about, you know, what does passing down gardening to youth look like in terms of being able to be educated and informed a lot earlier than, let's say, their family?
Mm-hmm. As we all know, the earlier you learn something, usually the better it sticks, mm-hmm. right? And the more it becomes a part of your character and in everything that you do in life. So even within the farm-based wellness program, we promote people to bring their children, If you have children, that's not going to be something that keeps you from being able to come to the program. We try to reduce all barriers as possible. So in that, we have the youth that come, they actually get introduced to the farm, right? They do activities around the farm. They do plantings. They do harvesting. And then within the general work, we're always saying, like, if you kids are around, if somebody walks by and they have a kid and they're looking at the farm, I say, come on in. Hey, take them over there. Let's go pick a cucumber. Mm-hmm. Let them see that cucumbers come off a plant, right? Let them eat a fresh cherry tomato off of a plant, right? It creates kind of connections within your brain, right? So people can, especially at a young age, can really be able to connect, hey, cucumbers don't come from a truck that delivers them to Stop and Shop, right? They come from this beautiful vine with these flowers and bees buzzing around, right? And nature all going on. So it really kind of connects them and grounds them if you can catch them really early and kind of show them. And I always say they may not become gardeners right now, but eventually one day they'll probably come back, as a lot of us do as we get older, and kind of reach back into those memories and say, oh, I remember doing this. Mm-hmm. It's not that hard, right? This is attainable. I've seen this in my own community, right? So this is something I can do.
I mean, eating a cherry tomato off a vine is very different from eating it out of a plastic box from a grocery store, that's for sure. And I do want to touch on this really quickly, because we talk about different kinds of physical spaces, but we know, gardeners know, that this is something that can really help our physical health. But research also shows that having green spaces can also decrease, you know, air pollution, noise, and promote mental and physical health, as we talked about earlier. So can you talk about that aspect a little bit too?
The more green spaces we have in the city, the better for all of those things. I actually was just lucky enough to have a conversation with someone from Lifestyle Connecticut, and even thinking about the more green spaces we have, the less light pollution we have.
Right.
And we sometimes forget how everything is connected, right? The creation of green spaces in abundance really not only helps us as people that are living within the city, it helps nature as a whole around us. It captures some carbon or a good amount of carbon, and the more we can at this point. We were just discussing how the seasons don't seem to line up in Connecticut anymore, and these little kind of small spaces seem like not a lot, but when you actually go back and look at it, when you start saying the difference between 55-60% green space, right, and canopy cover versus 75%, that is significant, right? Mm-hmm. That's enough percentage to actually have changes in, like, your available oxygen, right, when you're walking around, which actually changes how your brain is thinking, right, and kind of changes how your body is working.
And, you know, are there any events coming up that you want to let our listeners know? You know, how can people get more involved with these gardens? And I'm sure for some it might be a little intimidating. It might not be something that they're comfortable with just because they're not familiar. You know, what would you suggest?
I would suggest to anybody who's looking to get into gardening or already a gardener and just looking for a space, to visit our website, gathernewhaven.org. And sign up, send us an email, sign up for one of our community gardens. If you are new to gardening or expert, they are very welcoming spaces. We do a lot of training around those spaces. I'm always available, even now that my role has changed. I love teaching people how to garden, working with people who are kind of just getting on that journey. It's some of the funnest experiences that you can have, because you see that their eyes lighten up. And then also our nature preserves, if people just want to get out, our nature preserves, everything, all our properties are listed on our website. And then people who just want to get active and kind of contribute or help the mission go along, we do have volunteer events that are advertised on our social media and on our webpage. So Gather New Haven on Instagram or Facebook, you can find out in events that are going on, or definitely always our website. And for those great people who are looking to help us really with the mission in terms of fundraising, we do have two pretty major events coming on in the next couple of weeks. We have our Rock to Rock campaign, which is a peer-to-peer fundraiser that goes on in New Haven. There's you can jump on and do bike riding. It's a family-friendly event. It's kind of centered around the East Rock Park in New Haven. And we also have the Great Give coming up, which is a 36-hour day of giving or a day and a half of giving that really promotes kind of knowledge around a lot of the nonprofits in New Haven, but also supporting those nonprofits and the missions that they're doing.
Well, now I really just want to stick my hands in dirt right after this. So you've been listening to Jonathan Savage, who's the executive director of Gather New Haven. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us today, Jonathan.
Thank you for having me. This has been great.
And you can also join the conversation, 888-720-9677, or leave us a comment on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. ECMO is a leading-edge, life-saving treatment for patients with cardiac or respiratory failure. Dr. Jason Gluck, director of the Mechanical Circulatory Support Program and Emergency Cardiac Care at Hartford Hospital, explains what it is.
So ECMO stands for extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, outside the body oxygenation of blood. It's a life support technique that's used by highly sophisticated medical systems for patients with severe heart or lung failure. The technique involves removing blood from the body, oxygening it, and then returning it back.
ECMO procedures happen in the ICU, but not all hospitals are equipped with the necessary technology and staff. Dr. Gluck describes Hartford Hospital's ECMO Go team.
So ECMO is considered when treatments have failed, and in our center, with a special ECMO on the go team, we'll actually take that technology to their hospital and help them out there if they need to stabilize the patient and then bring them back to heart for recovery.
For more information, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Catherine Shen. Most homes are built with steel and concrete, but there's a new material being used to make buildings stronger, more energy efficient, and more sustainable. You might have heard of it. That material is wood. Joining us now from the NENC Collaborative to talk about this new slash old innovation in buildings is Connecticut Public's very own Abby Brown. She's our housing reporter. Thanks for being here, Abby.
Good morning, Kat.
And you can also join the conversation. Let us know if you have any questions, 888-720-9677, or find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. So, Abby, we know wood as a resource has been around for, I think, quite a while.
Yes.
But it's kind of had a resurgence, and it seems to be something that is greener and more sustainable. So can you tell us, what do we know about wood as a sustainable resource?
Yeah. So the story that I put together for Earth Day is specifically about mass timber, which is timber using wood. But it's specifically using like 7 to 8 inch thick slabs of wood as the walls, ceiling, floor, the whole shebang. And it's slowly becoming more popular in New England and the Northeast, but it's been a bit more popular for a while in the Pacific Northwest, in Europe, as a way to build these bigger buildings. Because typically when you think of wood, I mean, it's, as you said, it's not a new invention.
Right. I know, it's kind of surprising, but not at the same time, right?
But typically when you think of wood buildings, at least to me, I think like wood cabins
Sure. And
things like that. But people are building close to skyscrapers. They're building 10-story buildings all out of wood. And that is definitely a newer thing. It, like I mentioned, is bigger in the Pacific Northwest. And that's kind of due in part to there being kind of an existing infrastructure for that already. Mm-hmm. But it's sturdy. Obviously, there are buildings that have been around for hundreds of years that are made of wood. So it's sturdy. It has like an element of natural fireproofing. And it is sustainable, importantly, because it's a renewable source. So that's one of the main reasons why it's seen this resurgence in a new form of construction. Because as long as it's harvested appropriately and not just contributing to mass deforestation, it's a really good option because you can just continue to grow more.
And I think for those who are having a hard time wrapping their heads around this just because it's such a difference in terms of material. But can you talk about the difference between mass timber and traditional construction materials such as concrete and steel that we were just talking about earlier?
Certainly. So concrete and steel take a lot more energy and they release a lot more CO2, both in the construction process, in actually building the building, but also buildings emit just kind of a standing level of CO2. Even when they're finished and they're just existing, they're still kind of giving out those vibes. And the base level of CO2 that's being put out by steel and concrete is significantly higher than that which is put out by wood. So wood is puts out less CO2 in the actual construction process, but also just in standing once it's completed. It's emitting less toxins into the air, which is one of the main reasons why some consider it better than steel and concrete. Also, obviously, steel and concrete are not renewable sources.
Yeah, we would definitely like to have no less toxic vibes, I feel like, yes, when we're living in our homes. And because you mentioned wood, too, being a sort of a natural or natural material against certain kind of weathers and stuff. And because we've seen a lot of extreme weather patterns here in New England, can you talk about, you know, how does mass timber perform under weather events, especially against something like steel and concrete? And also because we're so used to the idea that steel and concrete is more protective, but that's not so, right?
Yeah. So in my study and the experts that I've spoken to that work in mass timber, this kind of didn't even come up as a concern, like weather issues. And again, hearkening back to the idea that wood as a construction method has been around a very long time. And there are, I mean, if you think about it, there are houses and buildings in New England and in Connecticut that have been around since the 1600s that are still standing.
Right.
So I guess it makes sense. You automatically think steel, concrete is going to be stronger, but there are these buildings that are wood and have been around for centuries. But it hasn't, it didn't really come up for as a concern for some of these developers I spoke with. They were like, yeah, it's 8 inches thick is the base level for these pieces of wood. And they're obviously enforced in other ways. It's not like just a house of cards made of wood.
Right.
There's still, you know, beams that are keeping them in place and things like that. And same thing, it's very common, as I mentioned, in like Oregon and Europe, and those places experience similar weather patterns.
Right.
And I haven't seen any stories or heard any concerns about, you know, a mass timber building collapsed out in Washington State or anything.
And I'm actually curious about cost and expenses of this versus using traditional materials. Do you know if there's a massive difference?
Yes. So that is something that I looked quite a bit into in working on the story about mass timber. And in New England specifically, it's a little bit more expensive initially. Has more of an upfront cost. And part of that is because, as I mentioned, there isn't kind of this solid infrastructure for the mass timber business in New England yet, in the same way that it is in the Pacific Northwest. So it costs a little bit more to get some of the wood over here and ensure that it's gotten soundly and safely instead of hurting the environment. It's kind of a chicken and egg issue because there are developers here that want to bring mass timber to the area, but it's difficult to do so because there aren't a lot of mass timber buildings to begin with.
Right.
So it's hard to get investors interested in building here if there isn't something already here to show them that it's worthwhile to start a mass timber lumber business to help import wood. Because, okay, there's only one mass timber building in, for example, all of Connecticut, which is not true, but... Say, for example, so that is kind of an upfront cost, is getting the wood here. Where mass timber is more cost effective than steel and concrete and traditional constructions is in labor. Mass timber construction sites, the average one, has like between 6 and 10 laborers, which is a fraction of what's needed for steel and concrete. And part of that is because a lot of mass timber buildings, the parts are kind of measured and put together off-site. So you don't have people on the construction site measuring things out and cutting the wood and, you know, melding things together on site. And most of that is done before it even gets there. So really, you just need people there to kind of put the puzzle pieces together. And then, of course, you know, do the inside infrastructure and utility maintenance and stuff. But the actual building itself has less on the ground work than steel and concrete. So you don't have to pay as much.
And so with that too, you know, do you have an idea of what construction waste looks like then in that case?
That's a good question. I didn't study particularly construction waste. Like I'm thinking, you know, how much wood is used that how much wood is cut that doesn't get used and things like that. I didn't look particularly at that. I mostly looked at kind of the energy impact. And there is less energy used. I can tell you that.
When I was going to ask, you know, what did you find out from that? So less energy used.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Less toxins emitted just in the process. Once ideally these developers are able to find a wood source that's closer, obviously less transport needed, less toxins put out in the air. But currently for mass timber constructions in New England, the wood is acquired from Canada. They get it from the southern United States and Europe. So other than Europe, it's not traveling super far, ideally.
And so now, well, thanks for sharing what you found. And we're going to hear from some of the people that actually you spoke to for your story. First, we're going to hear from Jeff Spiritos talking about the value of mass timber. And then we'll hear from researcher Amanda Smith from nonprofit Project Drawdown, talking about it being a good option for affordable construction. And then we'll end by hearing from Ricky Mullane with the Woodworks Products Council, talking about what it'll take for mass timber to be more popular in this region.
The environment is really causing us to, that's the mandate. And the affordability crisis is a mandate. And when you put them two together, you're really getting to the system of mass timber being worth a real second look.
It's going to be region dependent. I think it's important to look into the forestry practices of where you're sourcing that mass timber from. But yeah, it's, you know, maybe our best hope for reducing our use of concrete and steel.
The potential suppliers that are looking at coming, they want to see that demand is already here, right? They don't want to hear there's interest. They want to see that there are real projects. It's a chicken and egg problem.
So echoing that chicken and egg that you mentioned
earlier.
I
stole that from him.
Well, thanks very much, Ricky, for that. I know you touched a little bit about the fact that when it's a wood building, less toxins are released. Can you talk about other health benefits potentially for if you're living in a wood house?
Yeah, there are studies that have shown that being in a kind of a natural environment like that, people who live there have reduced rates of anxiety and depression. It just kind of releases some endorphins to be surrounded by nature, essentially, which is why it has become kind of, if not preferred, an idealized living and construction style for some multifamily homes, which is something that Ricky attested to in the story and in other cuts that I used. He says that it is looked at as a good multifamily option, particularly since there was an international building code change in 2021 that made basically it kind of assured developers that it's cool to build mass timber up to 18 stories.
Wow.
So previously it had been, I think, 5. And then this kind of said, it's safe. This is good. If you want to go taller, you can. And so since then, there have been a lot more multifamily homes and apartment buildings that were constructed with mass timber. There's one in New Haven that is currently being constructed that I wrote about last year. And it is going to be, I think, a couple dozen units and largely affordable housing. And so when I wrote about it previously, it's being developed by Jeff Spiritos, who we heard from. One of the kind of pros of this building, as he mentioned, was that there are studies that show it just kind of makes happier people. And so they're kind of excited to have children and families living there when it's done, which I think they hope to be maybe next year.
That sounds like a cool idea. So basically, wood skyscrapers and no toxic vibes is what we're going for today.
Yeah.
Perfect. You've been listening to Abby Brown, who's our housing reporter. Can't wait to have you back on again, Abby.
Thank you so much.
And coming up next, we talk about what renters and landlords alike are doing to make their homes more climate friendly. You can also join the conversation, 888-720-9677, or leave us a comment on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live from Connecticut Public Radio. I'm Catherine Shen. This week, the New England News Collaborative is marking Earth Day by reporting on the intersection of climate and housing. For homeowners, there are many climate-friendly solutions for homes, but for renters, it's challenging to invest in energy-efficient appliances and to install solar panels. Joining us now from Vermont Public Radio is Abigail Giles, climate and environment reporter. Thank you so much for joining us, Abigail.
Thanks for having me, Catherine. It's good to be with you.
Absolutely. Right back at you. So I want to have you tell us a little bit about the onus of this story and looking at the green solutions for renters. I mean, we have a lot of renters here among us at Connecticut Public, so we're super interested in this topic.
Yeah, same. I'm actually a renter myself. Essentially, you know, I was really curious. We are sort of in this moment where there is this historic influx of federal funding for things like home weatherization, electrification. I think a lot of folks in the climate space are really excited about this. And, you know, I was really curious about whether this money is going to reach renters. I know in Vermont, we actually have a pretty high home ownership rate, but roughly 25% of our housing stock are rental units here. And that figure is even higher in most other states in New England. So if you think about it, you know, heating buildings accounts for about 40% of Vermont's greenhouse gas emissions. I think for every New England state, it's the second biggest source of emissions. So as states start to set these, you know, pretty ambitious goals when it comes to reducing their greenhouse gas emissions, it seems pretty clear that without bringing this sector of the housing market along, it may be challenging to meet those targets. And, you know, in addition, I think there are a lot of environmental justice concerns about, the folks who have historically been renters, who are, you know, still renters, whether or not they're going to be able to reap the benefits of electrification and weatherization from a health and saving standpoint.
And you also spoke with Carlos Martin at Harvard, who leads the Joint Center for Housing Studies there. And we're going to hear a quick clip from him where he lays out that the economic dynamic of the split incentive, where landlords are often not incentivized to invest in lowering the emissions and energy costs associated with their property. Here's this clip.
So the split incentive means that if the renter is paying the utility bills, the landlord has no incentive of investing and paying for the improvements that would save the renter utility bills. If it goes the other way, that the landlord is paying for the incentive for the utility bills, the landlord has an incentive to make improvements, but the resulting effects on the renter could be higher rents.
So you mentioned some federal incentives and other incentives for landlords. Now, can you talk more about that?
Yeah. So, at the federal level, there is, essentially the Department of Energy has, you know, for some time had funding to basically help states facilitate, low-income households getting access to partial or, you know, complete funding for home weatherization. And that is one of the spaces where, you know, after all this sort of this influx of pandemic era federal spending, we're really seeing big investments. And Catherine, the one that is kind of, I think, most exciting, I'm hearing at least from our state energy office in Vermont, is the Inflation Reduction Act. And so states are still in the process of designing, what the programs that will come out of that funding will look like. But we're talking about, you know, tens of millions of dollars becoming available for the sort of projects that could potentially bring rental properties along. Mm-hmm. And the sort of catch here is that I think a lot of people don't really know that rental properties can fall into that category. So, for example, I know in Vermont, it was news to me that, you know, every state's sort of numbers are different, but if 25% of the tenants in a building, a multi-unit building, are income qualifying, landlords can actually get their properties weatherized for free. And, you know, speaking to what Carlos Martin had said about this split incentive problem, basically everyone I spoke to for this story said, you know, it's whole building solutions, whether that's installing a heat pump or replacing your primary heat source or weatherizing at scale, that really do the most to lower energy bills for renters and lower emissions. And they're also the most challenging projects to address because of that split incentive. So I think there's a lot of excitement and opportunity here around the possibility of this, you know, more federal funding, because, it, you know, if you have that influx of financial incentive, it can start to sort of alleviate that dynamic that he laid out, where landlords don't have the same ability that, say, a homeowner would have to recoup that cost. Another piece of this too is that in New England, like the rest of the country, it's usually renters who are paying for their utility bills. So, you know, if you're a homeowner, you may make the upfront investment in home weatherization or buying a heat pump. You recoup that cost via savings on your bill every month. So I think the question everyone's trying to sort of answer here is, how do we make it possible for a renter and landlord to be able to sort of navigate that dynamic together?
Well, then that actually rolls into my next question is, like, especially with what the landlords can do, what can individual renters do in terms of solution? Because clearly replacing a refrigerator is a big investment for a renter, or really for anyone. So can you talk about, you know, what are some things that renters can do to help sort of, you know, lower their cost in any way?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that most states do have some good programs around, you know, providing free, you know, more efficient, smaller appliances. So, you know, swapping out light bulbs, you know, your shower heads, those things actually do add up. You know, there are smaller things like turning down your thermostat at night when you're sleeping or when you're away at work. There are some opportunities to do some kind of DIY weatherization around windows. I also encountered a nonprofit that kind of does grasswork route around helping renters you know, folks in rural communities learn how to build window inserts that actually don't require screws to install, which again makes it sort of palatable for someone who doesn't own their home. So there are a lot of smaller things like that, but, you know, I think the really big stuff, like I said before, whole building weatherization, that's what's going to really make the dent for renters and for folks who are really energy burdened because of their bills right now.
And can you also talk about, we got about 2 minutes left here, but we'll love to hear about, because I know you're going into the field today to work on your next story. Can you tell us, what are you up to?
Yeah, I'm actually getting ready. It's tick season in Vermont, which is bigger, longer, and sort of more expensive than it used to be. So
right.
I'm working on kind of a story going out in the field with some scientists who are trying to sort of figure out why that is and what's happening and kind of what the factors are at play there.
And so with that, about 30 seconds left, you know, any final thoughts you have for our listeners? You know, look out for ticks, change your appliances or conserve water. Any final pointers for us?
Well, I think, you know, it's a great time to reach out and do research if you are a renter, because, you know, this can be a challenging problem to sort of address. But we are in this period where there is really unprecedented funding to do this sort of work. And your states very well may have programs that could help your landlord weatherize your space for free, which can save you really hundreds of dollars a year in energy costs, depending on where you live. So we'd just recommend doing some research and kind of reaching out and starting the conversation.
Well, sounds like a plan to us. Thank you very much. You've been listening to Abigail Giles, who's the climate and environment reporter with Vermont Public Radio. Thank you so much, Abigail, for being with us today.
Thank you, Catherine.
To learn more about the New England News Collaborative, visit nenc.news and see all of their Earth Day coverage. I'm Catherine Shin. Today's show is produced by Tess Terrible. Our technical producer is Dylan Reyes. Download Where We Live anytime on your favorite podcast app. And thank you so much for listening. Happy conserving.